So welcome everyone to our Jewish Community Center Lunch and Learn program, Abraham, Nimrod, and the Tower of Babel, or Bavel in Hebrew. What I'd like to do this afternoon is just to explore with everyone today two archetypes. On one hand, we have Abraham, Avraham Avinu, the patriarch, the founding father of the Jewish people, archetype of righteousness, and then the archetype of the dark side, shall we say, the negativity of our world, King Nimrod. And at the end of today, I think we'll find out and hopefully discover some interesting little tidbits that might be germane to our situation in the year 2015 in our world today. So let's begin with just a quick little context of the two of them. King Nimrod is the archetype for a rebel without a cause. He rebelled against God. As we'll see in a moment, the name Nimrod, which unfortunately is used today in the vernacular that someone is a little bit of a fool. You hear people sometimes say, you're a real Nimrod, which is essentially not a nice thing to say about somebody today. He is the source of despotism and negativity, as we'll see. Abraham, of course, the ultimate righteous individual, the source of not only the Jewish people, but many other great faiths, really the first monotheist in civilization that we know of, who brought monotheism not just to his own family, but to a world. So let's look inside the Torah. Let's look at Genesis 10, our first source, which actually tells us a little bit of who Nimrod was. And it says like this, number one, and Cush begot Nimrod. Now Cush, of course, was one of the sons of Noah. So in the aftermath of the flood, the Mabul, you had a very limited amount of humanity that was saved. Cush was one of the three sons of Noah who survived the flood on the ark. So it says that he gave birth, begot Nimrod. He, Nimrod, began to be a mighty man in the land, a gibor tzayid, a mighty hunter. He was a mighty hunter before God, before the Lord, and therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, there's a great Torah commentator, the number one biblical commentator, Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, and he's now going to pick apart and nuance the words that the Bible says, that the Torah says, and explain to us insight into the nature of who Nimrod really was, because a superficial reading sounds like he's a great, heroic freedom fighter, for all we know. But this is not the case. Number two, he began to be a mighty man. So what does Rashi, what does Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the medieval commentator, explain to us? From the oral tradition, he, Nimrod, began to cause the entire world to rebel against the Holy One, blessed be He, God. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the plan of the generation of dispersion. Meaning he came up with the entire idea of building this tower, what we later come to be known as Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babylon, and he began the ultimate dispersion of humanity across the face of the world. He was a mighty hunter, but not only did he hunt four-legged creatures, he apparently used to hunt two-legged creatures, metaphorically speaking. A mighty hunter, he ensnared people's minds with his speech and misled them to rebel against God, the omnipresent. Interestingly, there's another person, a character we meet later in the Bible, in Genesis, who is very similarly described, Esau. Esau is described as this man who, Yodea, who knew how to hunt. And the Torah says, well, what do you mean he knew how to hunt? You're a hunter. Just say he's a hunter. No, 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 no. He used words to manipulate and to hunt people. So we see that is used both as a metaphor for manipulation, politicking, if you will, and also in a literal sense. Both are true. So it works on two different levels. Before the Lord. What does it mean when Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord? What does the verse actually mean? He intended to provoke God to his face. So he was a very provocative individual who did not try to hide his intent. Therefore, it is said about him, you think, wow, what a great line, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Who would not want to be described with such a beautiful term in the Bible? Well, none of us would want to be described that way. Why? About any man who is brazenly wicked, in your face type wicked, who recognizes God, his master, and intends to rebel, therefore you have the word Nimrod, that's the shoresh of his name, that's the construct of his name in Hebrew. Anyone who wants to rebel against God, it is said of him, this one is like Nimrod, a mighty hunter. So he becomes an archetype for every wannabe James Dean, the rebel without a cause, in history of mankind. Now this is not a small issue. For the Talmud, it's not here, but I'm quoting, the Talmud explains to us beautifully that who are some of the progeny, the children of this Nimrod character? Well, you had Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, Ramses. And then you had someone who we're unfortunately very much aware of, King Nebuchadnezzar. He's considered a grandson of Nimrod. Again, we have to ask, is that literal? I mean, do they share DNA genetics? Or is it, again, what Rashi is saying, what the commentator is saying here, that anyone who shares the mindset of Nimrod is classified as a Nimrodian? That's probably the easiest way to understand it. Meaning it doesn't make a difference whether Pharaoh literally descended from Nimrod, whether Nebuchadnezzar literally shares Nimrod's heritage. That's immaterial. What is important is when one shares the mindset, the motivation of Nimrod, you become, for all intents and purposes, like Nimrod, a Nimrodian. So now let us discuss a little bit about what he was up to with the project. We're all familiar a little bit, maybe a lot, with the Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babylon. That's our little picture in the top there. Looks much nicer, by the way, in the full color version that the Browns have. The Browns were privileged because of their 60th wedding anniversary, that they are given the privilege of a full color rendition. Okay? And apparently Mr. Lance has even a more beautiful color rendition of the Tower of Babylon. Okay? So, let us look now at number 3. And we're going to just read from the Torah, from the Bible directly, without any commentary. And you're going to see something amazing. It sounds, instead of a negative, a utopian, beautiful world that this character Nimrod envisioned for the world. And we're going to have to ask the following question at the end. What was wrong with what he did? Why was God so irate at the project? So let's just read it together. Number 3. Now the entire earth, all humanity, was of one language and uniform words. So they spoke one common language, Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, the biblical Hebrew, God's language, the holy language. Plus, they had, additionally, tribal languages within the little tribe. But they all shared one common language. And they had uniform words. Their ideas were all the same. Sounds great. Achdut, right? It's the United Nations. Everyone's together on the same page. Sounds great. Sounds wonderful. And it came to pass, when they traveled from the east, meaning humanity, that they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. Remember, this is all of humanity. This is predating humans moving everywhere in the world. So they're all in one little area of the world. And they all live there in harmony, ostensibly. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and fire them thoroughly. So the bricks were to them for stones, and the clay was to them for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. Now, there's no worry about 9/11 because there were no airplanes back then. It wasn't a problem, okay? The bad guys hadn't invented that form of terrorism yet. Let's build this gigantic freedom tower and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the entire earth. Stop for 1 second, just keep your finger there. Now, the idea that they will be scattered is not unreasonable. They just survived the flood, right? They're worried, oh my gosh, we need to establish ourselves here because, oh my gosh, you know, God is capable of bringing another flood.
And the Lord descended to see the city and the tower that the sons of man had built. And the Lord said, Lo, they are one people, and they all have one language, which you thought was good. But listen to God's language. And this is what they have commenced to do? Now, God says, will it not be withheld from them all that they have planned to do? Oh my gosh, he says, what's going to happen? Come, he says to his fellow angels in heaven, let us descend and confuse their language, make them babble. That's where the terminology, Babylon, a person who is just speaking. You know, there's only two ways to refer to someone who just speaks without any reason, right? Either you're babbling or you're a politician. We're not quite sure which one it is, so, right? So let's confuse their languages so that one will not understand the language of his companion. And that's exactly what happened. And the Lord scattered them from there upon the face of the entire earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, God named that place Babel, Bavel, which means confusion. For there the Lord confused the language of the entire earth, and from there the Lord scattered them upon the face of the entire earth. Genesis 11, 1 to 9. So I ask you, superficially, just what we read, isn't this strange? What was the sin? What was the problem? So let's pick it apart, piece by piece. We start out by saying, United Nations harmony, one language, one thought process, everyone shared the same goals and ideas. Sounds good to me. It's utopia, right? We all dream we can live, right? Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. Let all the Jewish people live as tribes in harmony, brother to brother, sister to sister. Sounds great. And then they focus on the material, for some reason, that they used to construct the big tower project. Why is that important? It says, let's make bricks and fire them up. And the bricks became stones for them. So a simple explanation is that there was not stone available to them. Stone quarries didn't exist in that part of the world. So what are they going to build with? Therefore, they manufactured a workaround. They came up with the idea of uniform bricks. Great. Why should that even be interesting to us? Is that germane? We'll see in a moment, it is very germane. And then they say, let's build a name for us. Let's make a name for ourselves. Because God forbid we could be scattered across the earth. So let's make a name. Now you could say, well, that sounds a little suspicious, right? Because you're seeking fame and fortune. What does that mean exactly? We don't know. And then God comes down, and we learn from this that God didn't need to come down. We're talking, you know, metaphorically speaking, anthropomorphically. He comes down to judge, and we shouldn't judge people. We should learn until we see with our own eyes. If God sought the counsel of his angels before proclaiming, you know, let's mix up their languages and scatter them around, we should never judge people without seeing and understanding the nature of what was going on. So God comes down, and God goes crazy, essentially. He says, oh my gosh, look what they're doing. They're building a tower. It's going to be the end of humanity and creation. I have to scatter them around the world. And of course, ironically, what was their desire? To stay in one place, to be uniform. And what was their worry? They'll be scattered. As a result of what they did, they ensured success. They were scattered. The one thing they didn't want to do. Okay? It's a powerful lesson. Now, what did they do wrong? Now, the rabbis aren't on the same page here. There's no uniform opinion about what the sin was. Some say maybe the sin was arrogance. Let's make for ourselves a name. Let's go up to this tower which will ascend to the heavens, and we're going to make war against God, whatever that means. That's not a good thing. So that's one possibility, right? And that's right there in the text. You don't have to sort of extend the text more than what's written on the page to understand this. But why was God like, oh my gosh, he says, now that what's the next thing they're going to do, he says? They're going to build a tower and nothing will be beyond their limit. Okay, so what's wrong with mankind wanting to better themselves? What's wrong with the whole project? Sounds great, doesn't it? No? Okay. So let's discuss Nimrod. How does he fit into this? Well, we learned that Nimrod was the master of manipulation. And he used his charisma and his verbal skills to ensnare people, we said. A hunter. So he hunted people. He became the top of the pecking order. So if you learn your history,
You know that whenever you have uniformity, it's usually a good thing. Like if everyone's on the same page, if we all go to synagogue, for example, on Yom HaKippurim, and our goal on Yom Kippur is to repent, and we all have power together, all our voices are crying out to God, that's probably a good thing, right? Because then I get encouraged by your prayers, and hopefully my prayer encourages you. That's a good thing. But where is it a negative? When it's not willing, but it's enforced from above, it becomes a law. That is not kosher. Where do we see this? All throughout history, where you have enforced uniformity. Everyone shall conform. And if you don't conform, you have the non-conformist police knocking at your door, dragging you maybe to a gulag somewhere in Siberia. Does that sound familiar? So when it is not the people's choice, then it becomes a problem. So that's what the rabbis point to. They say that Nimrod said, look, let's all be on the same page. One language, one goal, one project, let's go. What if you were a dissenter? Oh, no, you don't dissent from Nimrod, or you will be crushed. Sound familiar? Look at the history of our world, right? Now, what an irony it is that there's always somebody coming up with the idea. Do you ever notice, though, that the people who are at the top of the pecking order are never subject to the laws of the masses? Do you ever notice that? I mean, look at our own lifetime. Everyone here is old enough to remember the Soviet Union, the evil empire, as President Reagan, may he rest in peace, once called it, right? Remember Brezhnev? He was like the bad guy from my youth. He had a dacha, a beautiful house on the Black Sea. So the rules didn't apply to Mr. Brezhnev, right? It didn't apply to Mr. Kosygin, who was the other big shot leader with Brezhnev. It didn't apply, you know, to Khrushchev or going back. None of them, they were exempt. They drove limousines and they had tons of money and they had yachts and they had it all. But to the minions who were crushed from Stalin's time, Yimach Shemo, all the way up to the Gorbachev end of the Soviet Union, what about the minions who were crushed? What about the Jews who could not practice their Judaism under the Soviet occupation? It wasn't so good for them. That is what we're pointing to here. In other words, the uniformity of language and thought was not free will. It was enforced from above. That's what God objected to. So if everyone is on the same page, great. But if someone is saying either you're on the same page or you're locked away in a gulag, not so great. So Nimrod was at the top of the pecking order. Now, how does this all relate, I pointed out to you, to the bricks? Why is it crucial that we know that they use bricks, not stones? Well, are stones uniform? Never. Because God creates stones through nature. What about bricks? Exactly uniform. So the idea that the Torah, the Bible, stresses the bricks in place of stones, it was the hubris, it was the arrogance of the people to believe, oh, I'm not doing this because I'm beyond God. I'm not going to rely on nature. I am above nature. I will manufacture my own bricks because they're uniform little units that will fit precisely into the tower. That's the nature of the uniformity again. Everyone had to be uniform, conform. Even the mechanics, the way they built the tower, had to be precise and exact. And the Medrash, the oral tradition, tells us the nightmare of what happened to the project. And we're all aware of what could happen. Sometimes good intentions begin, but then people focus on a project, whether it be a tower, like it is in this case, or something else. And what happens to the humanity of the project? Gone. And that's what happened here. The rabbis tell us that when they were constructing the tower, you can imagine, you look at that picture, it went higher and higher and higher, and it was laborious to get bricks from down below and to schlep them up top to keep building higher. And of course, as the tower grew exponentially, it became that much more difficult to bring bricks up. It took a lot of workmanship, a lot of travail. So they say that what happened when a brick fell off the tower? The people went nuts. Oh my gosh! It's going to take us 3 weeks to replace that brick. You idiot! You dropped that brick! You don't worry about it. It might have hit somebody on the head down below. Okay, that wasn't a worry. And the rabbis then say, but what if a human being accidentally fell off the tower building the project. No worry, because these are just a disposable unit. We didn't care much about the humans. The bricks, that was the project. So the project became the be-all, end-all to the point where it stripped the humanity of the people away. That was all they focused on, all they cared about. Humans mattered not. They're just units. They're little bricks to be replaced. The project, that is what matters. So we see now that when God descends, so to speak, metaphorically, and judges mankind, he sees the end of creativity, the end of individuality, and an end to humanity itself. And what is the greatest irony? From that project, the one thing, of course, as we said, they didn't want to happen, their nightmare scenario was what? That they would be scattered over the face of the earth? That's what happened, because when they forget their common language, Hebrew, and they can only communicate through tribal languages, which don't make sense to each other, one guy's asking for a hammer, the other guy thought he asked for a brick, and they get into a fight, and pretty soon nobody's getting along anymore, and they all scatter. So you have people going to China, and to Europe, and Africa, and all the places that they can walk to. So the irony is, when you take the constraints of the prison away, what happens? Creation proliferates. What happened in the aftermath of the Soviet Union being dismantled? Do you remember what happened? All these little Azerbaijan, Bilibajan, baby, you know, all these little places. There was Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. What happened to all the little ethnic populations? They all went crazy, right? They all had their own freedom. And they, some of them did not get along, so there were wars, yes. But what happened? Proliferation, right? Everybody just went and had their own identity back. All of a sudden, you heard of countries you've never heard of before. I mean, when I was a kid, the Olympic Games, it was just the Soviet Union. You didn't differentiate whether the person is an ethnic Ukrainian or from Azerbaijan or from Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan or wherever Stan you want to come up with, right? It didn't matter. They were just part of the Soviet bloc. You win for the glory of homeland, fatherland, the Soviet Union, right? The motherland. But then when all the constraints went away, when the walls came tumbling down, all of a sudden what happened? Humanity proliferated. That's what happened here. As soon as the project was forgotten because they couldn't communicate, they were babbling to each other, boom! Humanity, creativity, everything came back the way God had intended our world to be. And because of that, you have diversity. Now, you might say, well, it's a horrible thing because sometimes when you have that diversity, it comes at a cost, right? You have like genocide and horrible things happen like in Yugoslavia because people start getting overly sensitive. You know, are you this, are you that, and what's your ethnicity and what's your back? You're right, but it's still better than the alternative. The alternative was death to our world. So now we've explored Nimrod. We've discovered that Nimrod was at the head of the pecking order. He was at the top. He manipulated humanity to follow him. The project became the end-all be-all of humanity. Nimrod was the Mr. Rebel without a cause. He was the James Dean before James Dean. But we haven't spoken at all about Abraham. Where's Abraham involved in this? Uh-huh, I'm glad you asked. Abraham was a young man. He was about 52 years old. And he's walking past the tower. And they want him to join them. So, Abraham, are you going to join the project? He says, absolutely not. And, of course, we know, or you may have heard, Nimrod tried to execute Abraham. He forced him to worship idolatry with them. And when Abraham basically outthought Nimrod and convinced him, showed the audience that there was no idolatry, it was just a fake out, it was not real. He threw him into a fiery furnace, attempted to immolate him, and in the end, Abraham had to leave. And he leaves and comes to Israel. Right? That's the Lech Lecha Me'artzecha. He is leaving from his homeland because Nimrod's trying to kill him. Now, the irony is, Nimrod is not, even though he loses the day, because you can imagine, when people start babbling, the project is decimated. Abraham has shown the world that Nimrod's way is stupidity and vanity and non-existent. And so Nimrod loses his kingdom. He loses his job. The people rebel, right? Brezhnev is tossed out. The statue of Lenin. Statues of, you know, Nimrod are tossed over in the town squares there in Babylon. And Nimrod has to run away. But he makes a guest appearance a little later on in Genesis. He's one of the four kings who makes the First World War. See, you thought the First World War was 1914? No. They were told that there were four kings versus five kings, and they take Sodom and Gomorrah, the kings, their hostage. Lot, nephew of Abraham, is taken hostage. The guy who planned that was a man named Nimrod. He was one of those four kings. He was hoping to get Abraham in battle and to vanquish him once and for all. Now, how does Abraham fit into this then? You see, Abraham is the anti-Nimrod. He's the antithesis, the absolute polar mirror opposite of everything Nimrodian. Because what did Abraham dedicate his life to? Freedom. Freedom of mind, freedom from oppression. He wasn't really into religion, because religion can prison the mind the same way that real prison can. How so? What does the word religion come from? You know where it comes from? Ligament, ligere, in Latin. So the word religion means to keep going back to where that source was from, to keep connecting to the past, which is good when there is truth and honesty in your past, but it doesn't bode well for those who are connected only to the past and can't think through the mistakes of the past. They keep going back and drawing on a wellspring that didn't work in the first place. So it could be a problem. What was Abraham into? So Maimonides says Abraham was a freedom fighter. He wanted everyone to strip away idolatry and ask, okay, who created our world? How did we get here? Why are we here? And he wanted everyone to be free. He had debating societies that he set up. He wanted people to ask questions and to understand reality. And how does it play out? Amazingly. During the Soviet Empire, I'll use this as an illustration to you, there were people called refuseniks. Do you remember the refuseniks? Sure. Natan Sharansky, yeah. Ida Nudel, heroic, heroic people. How did they, the refuseniks, stand up to the evil empire? I mean, the evil empire was not a joke. They were real serious people who did not appreciate these little Jews trying to resist and get out of Russia or Soviet Union to get to Israel. They didn't appreciate it. They beat them. They persecuted them, and they would lock them away in a one-man prison somewhere in Siberia. But they didn't win the day, did they? They lost. For all the might of the Soviet Empire, and for everything nefarious that they did to the Jewish people, all those Jews are now living happily in Israel, whoever wanted to get out. Sharansky became a member of the Knesset. I had a great honor of meeting him. You ever see a picture of Natan Sharansky? Yeah, he's about 5 foot tall, pudgy. And I remember seeing him. He came in Memphis to the big synagogue. And the mayor of Memphis, African-American man, very handsome man, Willie Harrington, about 6'8". And he's skinny, so he looks like about 7'5". And he's up on the bima, on the dais, and you have him introducing Sharansky, giving like a key to the city of Memphis, you know, a ceremony. So I never forget this. Harrington's standing there. He's like 7 feet tall. And you have this little midget, pudgy little, you know, like a smurf, who's Sharansky, very unimposing man. And even Harrington looked at Sharansky and he looked at the audience. He realized the silliness of the scene. Here, he's this majestic 7 foot tall human being, beautiful, handsome man. And he's looking at little Sharansky and says, I know what you're thinking, like, how did I get here? And yet he's the hero. How did Superman become a midget, right? And he said, you know, I feel badly. So it occurred to me at that moment, oh my gosh, this man, 5 foot nothing, stood up to Brezhnev and to Kosygin and to all those guys. How? What happened? How did they do it? It's Abraham. It's Abraham. Because what did Abraham say? Two things. There's freedom. There's freedom of the heart and there's freedom of the body. Now, I can take away your freedom physically. I can incarcerate you. I can lock you away. But you can't take away the freedom here and here. And so as much as they locked away a Sharansky or a Nudal, they didn't take away their freedom. Because Abraham was someone who you could not strip freedom. And genetically, he passed on that DNA. Abraham and Sarah gave it to Sharansky and they gave it to Nadal. So you could have a people who are 400 years in Egypt, 210 years, they're prisoners to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh beats the living daylights out of them, whips them, taskmaster, throw your children into the water. What happened in the end? Abraham is told by God before he dies, your children one day will get out, they're going to have Passover, and they're going to get to Israel. And Abraham says, how do I know this is true? But my dog, he asks God, how do I know that this will happen? I won't live to see it. God says, you know how? Because they're your children. They will take no shortcuts, no compromises. They will never allow the freedom that's here and here to be taken away. And that's how we can explain how in the most nightmarish circumstances imaginable,
In Auschwitz, you hear stories of Jews keeping Passover and somehow getting a piece of matzah, or getting licht, getting candles at Hanukkah, and somehow you're lighting a Hanukkah candle in an Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp. Only a Jew could do this, and only progeny of Abraham. Because you can lock us away, but you cannot strip us of the Abraham freedom that Abraham passed on to us. I wish everyone a wonderful, wonderful day. May we continue to enjoy the gift that Abraham and Sarah gave us, the freedom of spirit, the freedom of the mind. And we wish for Achenu, Beis Yisrael, Be'eretz Yisrael, brothers and sisters in Israel who are living now under oppression of Arab terrorism, that this same gift that Abraham and Sarah has gifted to us is definitely gifted to them. And we wish them only Godspeed, and with God's help, Hashem Yazor, God will help them. Have a wonderful day.